DW, Living Planet, with Sam Baker.
Hello, and welcome to Living Planet. This week on the show, we're talking about the environmental impacts of just being born, as well as dying.
I've been very passionate about supporting and advocating for green burials for many years, actually. So I wanted to be able to have a boutique like this to help educate people about it.
But first, here's a question one of our listeners put to us recently.
Hello, this is Paul Sheridan from Bellingham in Washington State. I've asked Living Planet to investigate the impact of the increase in the world's population on the world's total resource package. Furthermore, I've asked how the climate models would be impacted if the world could unite and keep the population level at 9 or 10 billion people in the year 2100.
Thanks for your question, Paul. So what strain does our current population of over 7.6 billion people put on the Earth? How much is our population expected to grow? And how will this growth further stress natural resources and the climate? All that and more on this week's Living Planet. In 1968, Paul Ehrlich's book, The Population Bomb, came out. This seminal work laid out scenarios of worldwide famine, death, and ecological collapse in the following decades due to a burgeoning population. Our population has more than doubled from the 3.5 billion people on the planet then to today's 7.6 billion. But the book's most catastrophic predictions haven't become a reality. But how many people can the planet sustain? In 2017, researchers from Lund University in Sweden and the University of British Columbia in Canada calculated the greenhouse gas emissions of various actions people can take to reduce their carbon footprint. Air travel and becoming a vegetarian get a lot of press when it comes to mitigating climate change. But having one fewer child is actually the single most effective action people in developed nations can take to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. DW's Inneke Mules has a few quick facts about the environmental impacts of having children and how much this adds up when we take a more global perspective.
It's no secret that our population boom is becoming a bit of a problem for the environment, and it's only set to increase. It may not be an easy fact to swallow, but having children is actually one of the worst things you can do for the planet, no matter how eco-friendly your day-to-day life is. In fact, having just one child will add 58.6 tons of CO2 per year to your carbon legacy. By comparison, getting rid of your car will save just 2.4 tons of CO2 a year, and switching to a plant-based diet will save only 0.8 tons. Even in a baby's first year of life, the resources start to add up. Your average baby will go through around 2,500 disposable diapers by the time they're a toddler. But of course, not everybody has an equal carbon footprint. It really depends on where you're born. Developed countries by far emit more CO2 than developing countries. For example, an American child will generate the same amount of CO2 as approximately 106 Haitian children. And although Africa's population is expected to increase by 1.2 billion people between 2000 and 2050, this group will have the same combined CO2 footprint as 114 million US children born in the same time period. But if you take the world's entire population into account, then, assuming our population grows to 9.8 billion people by 2050, we'll be emitting 39 billion tons of CO2 per year. And if we reach 11.2 billion people by the end of the century, as the UN predicts, then we're looking at 44.8 billion tons of CO2 a year. That's an extra 14.4 billion tons of CO2 beyond what we're currently emitting. And that's just assuming our global consumption rates stay put.
That was DW's Inneke Mules. If population is a big factor when it comes to CO2 emissions, why aren't more people talking about it? Well, one advocacy group in the UK called Population Matters is doing just that.
Just so you know, I've got two girls. So I am not a sort of, you know, I'm not a misanthrope. I'm not anti-children, but it is a really compelling sort of conundrum for us at the moment as we see that impact upon the planet.
That's Robin Maynard, the director of Population Matters. We spoke on the phone and I asked him why his organization is focused on population as an environmental issue.
So we know that our planet is overstressed in terms of ecosystems such as our climate and our oceans, some of our water resources, forests and biology. We know there's an awful lot of pressure on the natural resources of the Earth and it's beginning to creak. And that's with a population currently of 7.6 billion people on the planet, which is about double that of that was around when I was born, you know, 60 years ago. So the population has increased dramatically. Consumption rates have increased, particularly in developed countries, but also, as they should in many ways, in countries outside of the of what used to be called, you know, the first world. So we need to see more people have a fairer share of the Earth's resources, but we're certainly not doing a very good job of managing our overconsumption in the very rich developed world. So we're seeing real pressure on the planet and our population continues to grow. The more feet there are on the planet, the more heat we see in terms of climate change, and we see more people becoming high-level consumers rather than sustainable consumers.
Especially when it comes to climate change and the amount of fossil fuels we're using and carbon dioxide we're putting into the air, that really is that combination of population plus consumption, right?
It is. And there are some really challenging statistics and concepts in that. The greatest growth in population across the world currently and as projected is going to happen in Africa. Mm-hmm. That's where sort of 50% of the projected increase of 2 billion plus people over added to the planet over the next, you know, 30, 50 years is going to happen. Per capita, individual Africans do not produce an awful lot of carbon dioxide individually. In fact, their sort of share of their sort of amount of carbon dioxide of people across the world has probably gone down over the past 40 years per capita. But as a continent, it's tripled because of the critical mass of people who are consuming more energy, more stuff, who need things to survive. And so there's a really difficult construct there. There's an awful lot of people who are not terribly wealthy and are not consuming an awful lot, but collectively they're bringing a great pressure to bear on the planet. So there's some real disproportionate responsibilities, but we have to think about population as well as consumption.
Right. But then when we look to countries, for example, in Europe, where we're both sitting right now, that have pretty high consumption rates, but the amount of kids each couple is having is going down and has gone down. That's more of the consumption side of things that really needs
well,
to
be. Well, it is and it isn't. I mean, for example, the UK, our consumption rates are such that if everybody in the world lived as we do on average, we would need three planets worth of resources, which is clearly not possible. And some of us are using a great deal more. So whilst we are and consuming an awful lot in the UK, we also have too high a population for the resources that we should have a fair share of. So we are already overpopulated in the UK. And they'd say, oh yeah, but the birth rate is going down. Yes, it is, but actually it's still higher than it should be in terms of the overall population. So we need to think about how do we reach a lower sustainable population, which is also consuming less. You know, that's something which we in the developed world really have to think about. We can't just talk about consumption, partly because all our wonderful environmental NGOs, we have utterly failed to persuade people to consume less. Consumption rates are not going down anywhere. And there was a great study by the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, which looked at about 60 of the main resources, goods and services that civilized society uses, what we see as a sort of, you know, average good life. Not one of those had gone down in use, apart from asbestos, some pesticides and toxic chemicals, and radioactive isotopes. So things that were controlled by governments or dangerous, we're not doing a very good job at reducing our consumption, which we have to do, but we have to reduce our population as well.
Before we get to kind of the solutions and how you get there, Is there a set number that is that goal to reach for worldwide?
It'd be dead easy if there were, wouldn't it? You know, wouldn't it be easy? But of course, you know, different countries are at different stages. And a small family in the UK means something very different to a small family in Africa, Latin America, wherever else. So it would be naive and crude and certainly unsuccessful if Population Matters or anybody else say, we should only have one child or two children now. What we really are trying to promote is the positive concept and the benefits of having smaller families, both for people and for the planet. We look at the UN projections for 2050 and 2100. They have three projections they offer. They have a low projection, a medium projection, and a high projection. And for 2100, so, you know, that's quite a long way off, but it's not that far in demography terms, 2100, their low projection is around 7.4 billion people on the planet, slightly fewer than we currently are at 7.6. Their median projection is 11.2 billion, and their high projection is 16.6 billion. And that huge difference hangs on the fact of the fertility rate going up or down on average by half a child more or half a child less across the world. It's one less child every second family or one more child every second family.
That was Robin Maynard, director of Population Matters. When you take into account birth and death rates, we're adding 83 million people to our planet every year. During this 30-minute program alone, nearly 5,000 people will have been added to the planet. To explore what Earth will look like with millions and even billions more people, DW's Ajit Naranjan joined me in the studio. He's been reporting on shifting populations around the world.
So Ajit, I don't want to ask you to predict the future, but what are the possible scenarios that experts are laying out when it comes to the population and where we're headed?
So the headline figure is about 11 billion people by 2100. So that's in 80 years. That's not so far away. That's within somebody's lifetime. And so this number is basically based on projections from the UN about how many children people will have, how long they'll live, and how quickly people die. And I think it's really interesting because if you look at the historical aspect of this, this is a trend that people wouldn't really expect. So human population has massively risen over time, and people are familiar with that. So from when agriculture was first invented about 10,000 years ago, I think there was something like only about 5 million people on the planet. And then comes the Industrial Revolution, and you see the population of the world doubling in about a century, and then quadrupling from that to what we have today. And I think what's interesting when it comes to population projections is that the mistake people often make is assuming that that sort of speed up, that massive spike we've had over the last 200 years or so, is going to continue. But what the experts are kind of saying is that it's actually going to level out.
Huh. Is that due to a leveling off of the fertility rate? So, say, each couple is just having two kids to replace themselves.
Exactly. So it's driven much more by the number of babies people are having than it is by how long we're living. And this has a lot to do with how people have kind of left poverty in large parts of the world and sort of these massive economic and health gains made in, say, Latin America, across Asia and Africa. And that means for any person, you don't need to have so many kids to kind of act as an insurance against this horrible reality for many people still in parts of the world, that some of your kids will inevitably die before they even reach the age of, say, five.
In the beginning of the show, I referenced The Population Bomb by Paul Ehrlich that came out in 1968. It predicted this kind of catastrophic, widespread famine and death across the world due to our increasing population. Our population has more than doubled since then, but in many aspects, humans have figured out ways to cope with that. For example, we've avoided widespread famine thanks to improved agriculture practices. Now, in some ways, that's not entirely true because we've contributed a lot to climate change, and that's continuing to happen. But what's to say that we won't figure out our population and consumption problems in the next century with technology and other innovations?
What we do know is going to happen is populations will grow, and in parts of the world which currently don't consume a lot, consumption will also grow. In parts of the world that already do consume a lot, that will continue to grow a bit, presumably, but their relevance as a share of the sort of total global population will start to shrink as other countries become more populous and richer. And so, I mean, when it comes to climate change, we are really talking about testing the limits of what the planet can take from humanity. But on the other hand, you can also see that the gains that humanity will make may well outweigh in terms of, say, stuff like famines, for instance. Famines have been dropping for ages. They are far rarer now than they used to be in the past. These trends could well continue.
I guess the question is whether the planet can sustain 9.8 or 11.2 billion people down the road.
So the answer to that, I think, is the planet can sustain 10 billion people in the future if they're consuming less than, say, the current Westerner consumes today. What humans, I guess, need to work out, what we need to work out, is sort of where does that middle ground lie? How many people can fairly be consuming on this planet? And I think that's a real question that we need to kind of be exploring.
Thanks, Ajit.
Thank you.
While we know what climate change is and the challenges it poses, what are the most effective solutions to reducing our greenhouse gas emissions? The organization Project Drawdown mapped out various solutions based on technologies and practices we already have available to reduce our emissions. They set out to answer the following question about these potential solutions.
How much impact could these solutions have if they were scaled kind of vigorously but plausibly around the world over the next 30 years? And could that get us to the point of drawdown?
That was Catherine Wilkinson, one of the senior writers for their book, Drawdown, the most comprehensive plan ever proposed to reverse global warming. Now, the term drawdown refers to the point in time when greenhouse gases stop rising and instead begin to decline year after year. And according to Catherine and her colleagues, we have most of what we need to get to that point. Their research ranked 80 climate solutions. The top solution is better management of our refrigerators and air conditioners. But there are still two other options that, taken together, would lead to even greater reductions in emissions. Those are educating girls and improving access to family planning. Speaking with Catherine, I asked why these solutions haven't been a bigger part of the conversation around climate change.
When you sort of step back and realize that so much of the climate conversation has been largely shaped by men, and in particular, white men, it's maybe not that surprising that this nexus hasn't gotten as much attention or as much airtime, even though our work shows that, indeed, gender equity can have an impact that is on par with wind turbines and solar panels and forests.
And why is that?
The size of the human family is a variable in how many emissions we create. I think it's worth being really clear that emissions are generated very unequally per capita around the world. So the affluent are by far having the greatest per capita impact. So you can't think about population in the absence of also thinking about consumption and production. But nevertheless, it is one variable that matters. And what I think is really important is that in contrast to a lot of the kind of environmental discourse about the topic of population, drawdown is really grounded in a very rights-based and frankly a feminist perspective, which is that it is agency, it is choice, not quote-unquote population control, that can have this incredible impact over the next 30 years of more than 100 gigatons of emissions avoided if we simply address the things that women and girls say they need and want and don't have.
So why does educating girls and improving family planning specifically have such a large impact on greenhouse gas emissions?
Education and family planning, it turns out, go very much hand in hand, because when women and girls have more years of education, they are able to make different choices about their lives, right? This is pretty straightforward logic. More opportunities, more choice, and oftentimes the choices that we see with more years of education mean marrying later and having fewer children. But of course, if you want to manage the size of your family or when you have your children, contraception and reproductive health care are critical for being able to do that.
Those are issues I don't think you see very often in many environmental movements or groups. So it's interesting to see just how important they are when it comes to actually addressing and reversing climate change.
This is also, you know, access to education, access to reproductive health care. These are really critical areas for resilience and adaptation as well. And we know that women and girls are already bearing the brunt of climate impacts, particularly under conditions of poverty. So anything that shores up our abilities to navigate challenges, whether those are, you know, sort of sudden and extreme sorts of challenges like natural disasters or shifting conditions for food production that are changing more gradually over time, we need to be ensuring that women and girls have as many resources and as many opportunities at their fingertips as possible.
That was Catherine Wilkinson from Project Drawdown. You can find their entire ranking of climate solutions at drawdown.org. Next up, we move from the environmental implications of creating life to what happens when our own comes to an end. Stay tuned.
Must have been frozen, little beyond them wild courses. Who knows how many poses that I've been in. Them that made crosses, hockey gives me mine. I cannot really post this.
While some might be thinking about having one less child to reduce their emissions, a small but growing percentage of eco-minded folks are now considering the environmental impacts their body will have after they die. Megan McWilliams has this report from the U.S.
The statistics on the environmental impact of conventional burials are staggering. In the United States alone, 30 million feet of wood for caskets, 90,000 tons of steel, and 800,000 gallons of embalming fluid are used for burial annually. By the way, almost none of this is biodegradable. Cemeteries not only take up large amounts of vital landscape, the chemicals and fertilizers used to keep the grass plush causes problems for wildlife, soil, and local water supplies. More people are considering alternatives and turning to funeral directors like Elizabeth Fournier, author of The Green Burial Guidebook, Everything You Need to Plan an Affordable, Environmentally Friendly Burial. Elizabeth offers a brief definition of natural or green burial.
Green burial is such a long revered custom of something we did quite naturally, and that's why they call it natural burial and green burial. We are having a loved one without embalming and without the processed casket, and we're not putting them inside a grave in the bottom, which has a liner around it. So we're being natural, going back to earth, giving ourselves back to the environment.
Some choose cremation, thinking it is the most eco-friendly choice. However, the average cremation releases 400 kilograms, or 880 pounds, of carbon dioxide. Yes, the stuff that is causing all the trouble in our climate. Unfortunately, there's more. In addition to the carbon dioxide and toxic pollution from the actual burning of a body, the energy it takes to conduct a cremation is the CO2 equivalent to an 805-kilometer or 500-mile drive. Yes, per body. But there is one emerging alternative to cremation that may have the least negative environmental impact: alkaline hydrolysis, also known as water resumation, biocremation, or flameless cremation. A variety of funeral services and companies involved in alkaline hydrolysis claim that it reduces the carbon output by 75 to 90%, generating 10 to 15% of the carbon emissions of standard cremation. Fournier describes the process.
It's done in a large stainless steel cylinder, and the person's former life vehicle really comes down to being some bone and some water, and the bone is ground down into cremains. So you're getting cremated remains in an urn just like you would if you were having a standard cremation. The big difference is we're using the low temperature. We're reducing carbon emissions. Think about a nice, cozy, soothing bath, a little bit of water going back and forth. They say this sort of cremation is really akin to the process of the body with green burial, just slowly going back to bone.
Gina Colombato, a death educator in Portland, Maine, talks about why she has asked her family to use alkaline hydrolysis when the time comes.
I spoke with a funeral home director, and he was telling me that when they burn bodies, every 3 years, they have to change out all of the bricks, because of course bricks are porous. Over time, the heat will be breaking down that brick. So the brick all needs to be replaced, and the system of ventilation and filtering has to also be replaced. So there's a lot, again, environmentally that we're doing there.
More and more people are planning ahead. And in addition to funeral homes that offer greener options, there are now specialty shops that offer education and products for natural burial options. One of these boutiques opened in Nyack, New York, and is called Dying to Bloom. Owner Carrie Potter explains.
I opened the shop out of a desire to help promote green burials. I've been very passionate about supporting and advocating for green burials for many years, actually. So I wanted to be able to have a boutique like this to help educate people about it, as well as provide products that they may need in order to facilitate a green burial.
Dying to Bloom is perhaps the first burial boutique of its kind in the United States. It is nestled on a quaint street and looks like any other inviting shop on the street. When you walk in, you see a pleasing display of natural burial products interspersed with flowers, comfortable chairs, paintings, and quotes like, "Earth my body, air my breath, water my blood, fire my spirit," which is painted in gold on the wall over a beautiful natural wooden casket.
To be honest, I kind of made it up as I went along. I had a vision of what I wanted this shop to look like, and I wanted it to be warm, welcoming. Unfortunately, I've helped plan several funerals, and I can tell you that I really don't like that feeling of walking into the funeral home. I would love the opportunity to be able to open a funeral home like my shop that just feels a little more natural.
Bonnie, who works at Dying to Bloom and is a millennial, has found a way not to dispose of, but to actually upcycle her body.
I'm a millennial, so a lot of millennials probably have not thought about this topic at all. But I kind of know what I want, and so I do talk to my family. And my current plan, it probably will change in the future, but I'm thinking I want to donate my body to science and use some of the money that would have been used for a funeral and just have my friends throw a giant party, just celebrate.
Like Bonnie, more young, healthy people are doing their homework and choosing greener, natural burial options and letting their families know how they prefer to leave the planet when their time comes. For DW, I'm Megan McWilliams in New York.
That's all we've got today on this Life and Death special of Living Planet. Thanks to Paul Sheridan from Bellingham, Washington for his question. And if you have a question you'd like us to tackle on the show, send an email or voice memo to livingplanet@dw.com. For more environment news, check out our website, dw.com/environment. And if you like this show, please recommend Living Planet to a friend. Subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And maybe even rate us on iTunes. Our studio manager this week was Ileana Ghilarducci. Christoph Groove was our studio technician. A big thanks to Inika Mules and Irene Quill, who helped with production. And I'm Sam Baker. Thanks for listening to Living Planet. We'll be back next week with more environment stories from around the globe.